Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, I will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to thriving today in our constantly changing and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, our topic today is professional intervention training. And fortunately, for those of us in the field of helping others, Southworth Associates and Intervention 911 have joined forces to offer training for those professionals looking to become interventionists, with their next training coming up January 22nd to 24th in sunny Orange County, California. Now, with over 65 years of combined experience in the field of addiction and recovery, they are ready to share their extensive knowledge with attendees and prepare them for a successful career as interventionists. Joining us to discuss this is Ken Seely and Eric McLaughlin. Now, Ken is a certified intervention professional, board registered interventionist level 2, registered addiction specialist, and certified addiction treatment counselor, applying his experience and enthusiasm to change the lives of people who suffer from the disease of addiction, for addicts, their family, and their friends. As the founder of Intervention 911, one of the most prominent private intervention services in the country, he conducts up to 5 intervention trainings a year. Now, Ken has been featured on the Emmy Award-winning and 2015 Emmy-nominated A&E television series Intervention. He was a presenter to the British Parliament on intervention and continuum of care to help create lasting recovery for those suffering from addiction. Ken has shared that he still derives great personal satisfaction from the hundreds of interventions he has conducted, organized, or facilitated through Intervention 911. Now, Eric is the CEO and CFO of Intervention 911, bringing over 15 years of management skills to the company. And all of those that I've spoken to have said that Eric has had a positive impact on the operations of the company on all levels, adding that Eric's commitment to providing services to those in need expands his involvement working with clients and often their families who are facing difficult decisions in the recovery of their loved one. Ken, Eric, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hey, Alan. Nice to meet you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. I have followed some of your trainings. I have followed quite a bit in regards to what it is that you've been doing out there, and it's just fantastic. It is so great to know when there are people out there that are literally doing the work that is necessary to help make people just make better decisions, you know, and in the long run, improve their life.
Yeah, we're excited. We're excited. We've been doing this for quite some time and seeing some amazing results, and we'd love to share it with you and all your listeners to hopefully give some peace of mind.
Well, that would be great. And let's start with, and I know most of the people listening would know this, but I think there are some people that would like some clarification. So let's start with what an intervention is and what its importance is.
Yeah, and this is Eric, and thanks so much for having us on the show. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here because the intervention is so important to the recovery process. It can be the first step or the spark that takes someone from a life of drugs, alcohol, untreated mental illness into a life of recovery. And the wonderful thing is that a true intervention addresses the entire family dynamic and not just the individual who's using. I think interventions historically, when they first came out, were more focused on, you know, the person who had the issue, and have since developed into a family first approach to healthiness and healthiness and recovery for everyone involved. And an intervention is basically an interruption of any kind of negative behavior, whether it be drugs, whether it be alcohol, whether it be failure to remain medication compliant in the treatment of illness, behavioral. It can be used in any family system. And what it is it's an examining of that family system and helping the family redirect to a healthier way of living. So it's a very all-encompassing process, and a lot of people think an intervention is an event, but an intervention is actually a long-term, lifelong process that starts, hopefully, recovery in a new and meaningful way for people.
Well, I want to tell you, first of all, I want to thank you for sharing that. I have a story just from the standpoint of having referred families to you. And our company has done numerous Dr. Phil shows where we've done the transport after Dr. Phil is finished with explaining to a young person that they're going to go to a program, and then we've been the company that's there to take them. And every time one of those shows is rerun, or every time it's aired, we get hundreds of calls. I mean, literally, because we get them in different time zones. So, you know, if the show is aired in five different time zones, you know, we're going to get 20-25 calls per time zone of people that call up and say, can you come get my child, or come get my young adult, come get someone and just take them off to a program. And one particular call that I recall was a parent who called up and said, we just saw you on there, and can you come get my son and take him to one of those programs? And I said, okay, can you give us a little bit of information? First of all, how old is he? They said, he's 26 years old. I said, well, first you have a problem. I said, do you have a conservatorship? No. But, you know, he's been living in his room. He's doing all kinds of drugs. We can't get him out of the house, and just come get him and take him anywhere. I said, well, let me first explain what you need first. And what you need first is you need to be able to have somebody come out. You need to have a form of intervention that comes out, because at this point in time, he's making his own decision. You know, you don't have a conservatorship. He's not underage. We can't just show up and take him somewhere. And so we, in that situation, we'll ask where they are geographically. In that situation, I referred them to your company, and I ended up getting a call back about 6 months later because the show had aired again, only this time it was the parent calling saying, we just wanted to call and tell you that we took your advice and we used that company, that I-911, and guess what? We are calling to give you a happy story. We're calling to tell you that our son has now been in treatment for, again, it was approximately 6 months. They said he is doing wonderful, and we just wanted to call and thank you, and it reminded us when we saw you on the show. So anyway, so that's one of the success stories that I think everybody needs to hear as to the value of having a true interventionist come out and work with their young person, which isn't always necessarily a child.
Yeah, that's great. It's a real good illustration too of a lot of times how families feel is that there's been so much destruction, there's been so much chaos that they just want it to stop, and they think the best way to stop it is to remove that piece of the puzzle. But what happens is that piece of the puzzle has to come back. Mm-hmm. Eventually. And if nothing changes, then you won't expect new results. And everybody has a role, everybody plays a part, and everyone has responsibility in any family system for either supporting recovery or supporting addiction. And it's hard because sometimes what is supporting addiction feels counterintuitive to being a parent or being a spouse or being a child. It feels like, wait, how can I do this? This isn't what a mother does to her son. And we see parents struggle with that all the time. But what you learn as part of an intervention is you learn a new language and you learn a new way of dancing and you learn that we're going to draw a line in the sand and we're going to support only things that are in recovery. And we're not going to support things that feed the addiction. And when families do that, the change is profound. And I've never had one family say to me, gosh, I wish we hadn't done this. I wish we hadn't done an intervention. They all say, regardless of the outcome, I'm so glad that we did this.
And I think that's a great point because, like you said, you're working with everybody. And I think that's a great point that many people need to hear is, you know, you have this picture of maybe what television has shown you, which is, you know, an interventionist is a group of people sitting in one room and the person walks in and they're surprised that everybody's there. And then they all start talking about it. So share a little bit about the preliminary things that are done prior to getting to that point to where they're now talking directly with the person in need.
Yeah. So just so I understand. So what you're saying is, you know, what kind of steps does the family take to be able to reconnect in a positive way with their loved ones after an intervention happens?
Well, that and even before, you know, that as you said, it's a much wider spectrum than just focusing on that one moment. So what would be some of the things for some of the parents that have chosen to listen to this show today and it's going through their mind right now, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to proceed now. I don't know how to get my, you know, my 26-year-old out of the basement. You know.
Yep. Well, I mean, I think the first thing is to understand that even as parents, we don't always have the answers. And I love to tell parents, you know, you're not given a book when your child is born that says how to deal with my drug addicted 26-year-old who lives in my basement. I mean, unfortunately, you know, I wish that we had that kind of available to people, but it's not. And what we see is more and more that's happening. And I couldn't begin to guess all the reasons for that, but there is a lot that families can do. And I think that one is understanding and believing that they can do something different is a real key. So reaching out to a professional, and when you reach out to a professional, it's a professional that has experience specifically with addiction. You know, we see a lot of professionals who are really qualified and great at what they do, but they don't necessarily know enough about addiction, so they may not give you the best advice. So it'd be like going, you know, you have a heart problem, but you go to a brain surgeon to operate on your heart. A brain surgeon's very smart, very gifted, knows a lot about the brain, but maybe they wouldn't be the best person to operate on your heart. And it's the same thing. Seek out a professional who has experience with addiction. Maybe they've worked with addicted clients. Maybe that's the focus of their work. And someone who understands the intervention process, because the intervention process is about creating that spark and really creating a change in that situation. And Ken's going to talk a little further about that.
You know, I think Derek's saying it's really important to really have the family members on board and to create that rock bottom. Without, you know, I don't know anybody that wakes up in the morning and says, today's a beautiful day, I just got a raise and I got engaged and I want to go get some help for my addiction. You know, it's in that crisis mode that they choose to want to change. So that's what the intervention process is really about, is helping the family create that process to want, for the addict to want to change. Like that saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. You know, we get the horse really thirsty. We get the addict really thirsty, and they want to get into recovery.
Yeah, I think that's a great point as far as is getting them to the point in which they understand that they want to or how much they need it. And the analogy of the two different doctors, I've run into that same situation. And, you know, parents will say, well, you know, here's the problem I'm having with my child. And they'll start explaining what it is. And then they'll say, but, you know, I think I'm going to be able to deal with this because my brother-in-law was a school counselor. And I think he can go ahead and help him. And I said, well, Did your brother-in-law work directly with people that were dealing with an addiction? And he says, well, I'm sure he must have at some point in time. You know, you know, and I'm saying, you know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with your brother-in-law, but do understand that there is a difference in that issue of addiction, that without having somebody that specializes in it, you're really taking a risk that the person is not going to be able to get through to them.
Yeah, and Alan, what you're saying is exactly right, Alan. It's shocking because even people that do work in the field of addiction recovery, they don't understand the intervention process. You know, this client-centered care that, you know, is so well, you know, described out there in the industry, which is really, you know, okay, I have a heroin addict that's been shooting in their neck, in their veins in their neck for the last 6 months, but all of a sudden they know what's best for them. You know, so it's mind-boggling that, you know, people don't get the intervention process. Even people in recovery don't get the intervention process. Like I said earlier, nobody gets up and says, it's a beautiful day, I'm going to go get some help. There's a crisis, and if we can't create that crisis, then we let for the natural progressions of the disease to happen, and the crisis ends up being death. I mean, I think that I saw the statistics of 2014. There was over 45,000 people that died in this country alone. So, you know, this epidemic is wiping people out. So you can let the natural progression of the disease take its course and kill people, or you could intervene, you know, and take a chance and do something that's uncomfortable and, you know, I guess the good part to put is it doesn't go with what your intuitions tell you to do, because you have to put healthy boundaries into place and you have to, you know, do things against what you would normally think would be helpful. But nobody gets better without a crisis. Nobody. Mm-hmm. I don't know one person that goes to a therapist. I know I've been in therapy for years, in and out of therapy. It always helps. And I don't go there when things are well. It's when I'm in a crisis mode.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? You know what, we're getting an instant message coming in, and your point about the fact that somebody may work even in a facility, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they understand how to deal with intervention. This instant message is coming across that says, I work at a treatment facility in Utah. As much as I would like my employer to pay for me to get out of the snow and go to sunny California, I don't think they will go for it. Do you have any training scheduled in or near St. George, Utah? Even Vegas would be within driving distance.
Yeah, we unfortunately this year we don't have any. We're going to be in Michigan, Florida, New Jersey, and then Austin, Texas. That's where we are this year. But we have done before, you know, we can work with facilities to do on-site trainings. So if that would be something that they would be interested in, we could come out and do some intervention trainings on-site. We have done that in the past as well.
Okay, and I think that's a great point. So again, this person, thank you so much for taking the time to send in an instant message that, you know, again, although you may not get a trip to sunny California, it may be that if there's enough people there, either at your facility or maybe by bringing in some of the people from some of the neighboring facilities to be able to set up an in-house training to be able to train multiple people at your program. So again, thank you for that question. Thank you for taking the time. So, you know, let's go to the fact of just kind of getting into that line of business, because we're talking about the fact that there is a difference. There's a difference between working within a program, although the training that you would get from this will certainly help that. You know, let's talk a little bit about how someone gets into the business of being an interventionist that is working out in the field with families.
Yeah, and I think this is Eric. So, you know, one of the issues I think for a long time that has I don't want to say plagued our industry, but it's been a challenge, is that intervention is relatively new, you know, in terms of popularity as a career experience. And there are a lot of, you know, people who have grown up through the ranks and, you know, they were intervened on and then they've said that this is something that they're passionate about and they want to do. And there hasn't been a whole lot of oversight or regulation. And we've been fortunate to be part of a couple groups who have sought that out, you know, to be able to add some accountability to people who want to call themselves interventionists. And both Ken and I are certified intervention professionals, or CIP interventionists. And that's a certification that's offered that has a national standing for interventionists. And it has a certain amount of requirements. They look at your work experience. They look at your education. And then they look at actually having some time doing supervised interventions. And the qualifications to meet that standard are very specific, but they, one of the creative things that they did was they said that if you have a certain amount of education, that will impact how many kind of work hours you need. So there's a lot of flexibility for people who maybe don't have as formal an education as others, but have been working in the field for a long time. And then the other component of that certification is that they require specific training on certain pieces of intervention, intervention, pre-intervention, aftercare planning, and family. And that's what we offer through our training. So we offer an opportunity to get 25 of the 80 specific credit hours that are needed at each training. And so that's what we do as part of the training. So the trainings are a really good opportunity for someone who's newer in the field that maybe wants to explore if they've done an intervention before. And it's also good, we've found that it's been good for people who are seasoned, who are looking to get their CIP certification. And then the other thing that we really focus on is the opportunity to understand and get to know really great other providers who want to hold themselves accountable to a high level or high standard. Because it's really, you know, we can't do every intervention that's out there. So by knowing, you know, the good people like Southworth and other people that do interventions, we have the ability to kind of meet clients' needs where they are, either geographically or financially. And we do that by building a good network through our trainings.
Well, and I am so supportive of that, because then I look at it as raising the bar. I think for any industry, especially one that is somewhat new, as you were saying, that if you raise the bar and you govern yourself, that keeps the government from coming in and deciding that they're going to make decisions and that they're going to try to govern things, which may not necessarily be the best way to go.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, for me, I actually just recently started a Master's of Social Work program to get my, you know, my goal is to get my LCSW. And, you know, that's a heavily regulated, very specific requirements that it takes. And I'm not adverse to intervention, you know, having that requirement down the road. But I think you're right. I think if we can inform what's important, if we can come to a consensus as a as an industry as to, you know, kind of some best practices and best ideas, you know, certainly this is because interventions are not therapy. You know, you're not doing therapeutic work in an intervention setting. There's a different skill set. You don't need to be a therapist or have a license as a therapist to be a good interventionist. It doesn't, one doesn't necessarily correlate with the other. So I think it is important that we allow for people who are really good at this to be able to have the framework to be able to do it in a very responsible and safe and professional way.
Now, as I had said in the introduction, you have a training coming up this month. Share with our listeners kind of what it entails, what they can expect if they were to be able to attend one of these trainings.
Yeah, so the trainings are, they're actually a lot of fun, first off. You know, we believe that, you know, learning doesn't have to be boring or, you know, kind of not fun. So we like to have a lot of fun. We usually generally have about 40 to 50 people at our trainings. And the trainings are, you know, like I said, first and foremost, they're an opportunity to learn about intervention. And we focus on a whole host of different pieces of the intervention. We talk a lot, kind of an overreaching theme is the idea that, you know, interventions aren't about a specific person. They're about a specific system, but not a specific person. And I think that we do a lot of good work around that. We also talk a lot about what is the end result of an intervention, because yeah, it's great that they go to treatment, but if they just come back home and nothing changes, what's the difference? So we talk about recipes for long-term care. What are the important components of long-term care? What are kind of some best practices for the industry? We also talk a lot about ethical considerations for interventionists. You know, what is important to know? How is it important to behave? We talk a lot about treatment centers. What do you look for in a quality facility? How to negotiate on behalf of the family system to be part of the treatment process? How to understand, you know, kind of what is an intervention-friendly facility versus a not intervention-friendly facility, which can be a real, real important piece, particularly with some of the more challenging clients. It really is an amazing opportunity to network and to meet other peers. We get people, you know, who are interventionists who have been doing interventionists for 15, 20 years. We get people who are, you know, a year sober and kind of exploring whether they want to do this type of work. We get admissions people from treatment centers. We get residential counselors or staff from treatment centers that, you know, are on the front lines working with the clients, and they're the ones who are, you know, working with their clients who are, you know, going to leave at 1:30 in the morning when there's no counselors on site, when there's no therapists on site. So we really try and kind of we broaden kind of the application of intervention. The concepts are all the same, but we broaden the application, and we do a lot of role plays in which people participate. Ken and John will also conduct a pre-intervention and intervention. So, you know, one of the things we really focus on is, you know, you have to really develop your own style of intervention. You have to use a framework that is successful, but also find something that works and is malleable to your own personal skills. You know, if you don't feel comfortable being able to do a traditional 2-day intervention where, you know, the client doesn't know that the intervention is happening on the day of it, if you don't feel comfortable being in that situation, there are other ways and styles that you can incorporate into your own intervention style to be successful. So the trainings are really a lot of fun. You know, we start each one off with an open 12-step meeting so that everyone can kind of get that experience of what it's like to have, you know, a recovery type meeting. And we just always have a blast.
We have an email question coming in along these lines, and this one reads, I'm a family therapist in North Carolina and would like to know more about the scope of your workshops and how other therapists are applying the training to enhance their particular practices.
So, yeah, this is Ken. I think the best way to answer that is, you know, a lot of clinicians, I had a physician that was, you know, an addiction psychologist that came to it, that retired from his job, and he wanted to learn more about the intervention process. And he said, this is one of, you know, as a physician, you know, you have to continue with your continuing ed every year and all that training. He said, this was so engaging, our intervention training, that, you know, he didn't want to get up to use the bathroom because he felt like he would miss something. So that was one of the best compliments that we got, is everybody feels like, while they're there, there's so much information that is, you know, being fed to them that they don't want to miss out on anything, because the techniques of, you know, like Eric was saying, reducing AMAs. I mean, all the millions of dollars that go out there to market to get people into treatment, and then they get there and they start the detox process and they're out the door. But by getting the family system involved, you know, reduces AMA. So that's why it's really good for a treatment provider, you know, somebody like themselves to come in. And, you know, when you see somebody that's coming in, even if it's a private practice and you have a patient sitting next, you know, across from you, and they say, yeah, this stuff isn't really working for me, you know, intervening, because again, we are losing way too many people. We need to make a difference out there. We need to do something different. And just to add on what Eric was saying, what we're doing this year in 2016 is we're breaking our five trainings up into modulars where, you know, each modular is going to have a different topic. And we're going to be breaking that out in this week where you'll really have, you know, more information. And we're going to bring you from the very beginning stage to the very end stages with supervision through that process.
Well, that sounds great. You know what? We're going to take a break right now. But again, everybody, stay with us. Our topic is professional intervention training. If you are at your desk and you want to open up another window and you want to follow along or you want to look at what some of the other locations for trainings are, you can go to i911events.com. You can follow along with us. But again, stay with us. We will be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. We're talking with Ken Seeley and Eric McLaughlin. And we are talking about professional intervention training and some of the great value that you can get from learning this and the fact that it can help you while you're working in a program, as well as working with families out in the field. So, gentlemen, I mean, if someone wants to sign up for the training, how can they go about it? Do they go to the site that I just gave?
Yeah, they'd be able to go right to the site, i911events.com, and click on the training, and there's a whole host of registration type boxes that they have to fill out, and then they could submit that right online. And there's also some contact information for those who are less computer literate. We know that there are some of you out there, and that's okay. You can go ahead and reach out to the phone number or the email that's listed on the website.
All right. Now, we've got another email question in here, which I think, again, I'm just so appreciative that people take the time to do this. And I know that the show is in the middle of the day, so to take the time the night before to send in an email question, I'm very thankful for that. This one reads, what education or training do you need to be accepted into the workshops? I have been an employee at a girls' therapeutic program for 2 years and would like to have greater opportunities in this field. After taking the workshop, do you also have recommendations or connections for career opportunities and or advancements?
Yeah, so there is no requirement to be part of the training. And I think that for someone who is kind of new into the field or new into thinking about a new kind of direction in the field, it would be really helpful to have a better, more thorough understanding of what goes into becoming a certified intervention professional. And they can do that. You know, they can call us and we can help kind of talk them through that. Because there is a bit of a process, and depending on what your experience in education is, it's not something like that you come to the training and suddenly you're a CIP. The training, however, is a really good opportunity to, I think, to develop and see what kind of, if this is something that would be interested. And it's the networking that goes on at that training that is really the key to developing work relationships. We do have a section that talks about kind of the business of intervention. We talk about, developing your own company. What does a referral relationship mean? How does that work? What are the ethical considerations of that? How are some ways to market yourself? What kind of conferences would be good conferences to go to? But this is, in my experience, it's kind of funny. We're all in the same business, but we really work well together. And that's the kind of professionals you want to work with that will support you. We've done lots of continuing training with people post one of our specific 3-day trainings in terms of mentoring, offering supervision, as well as, even having some people who trained with us, come along and ride shotgun, so as it were, on an intervention. And some of that could be a little challenging, to kind of plan, but we always make that opportunity available to people if that's something that they're interested in. So it may be a little bit more information that I can give based on specifically, kind of a specific situation, but the training has no requirements for attendance. You don't have to be a certain education level or certain experience level. And I do want to just make sure that people realize that, if you do only one training, you will not leave that training a certified intervention professional. There's a little bit more to it, and I can help walk them through that.
Okay, that sounds great. Yeah, you had said earlier that they would get, approximately 25 credit hours for going to one of the trainings, but yet there is 80 that's needed. So that makes perfect sense that you're not going to run out and in 3 days have everything that you need. So for them to get the additional credit hours, is some of that gained through just work experience? So we had one person that, this person said they've been working in a therapeutic program for 2 years. So is that something that adds to their credit experience?
Yeah, so that's something that's determined by the Pennsylvania Certification Board are the ones who do the certification that offer the CIP. So they're the ones who are make that determination of what kind of qualifies for their credential. But the way it works is that they look at your work experience. And the good thing about someone who's worked in a therapeutic setting, that person's probably already doing interventions of some form. So, they may have the skills and the ability, and it's just more of the formal supervision in a more traditional intervention style that's really focused on intervention and not so much set in a therapeutic setting. So that would be, again, it would be kind of on a case-by-case basis, but 2 years experience, would be a good chunk of the requirements completed for the CIP. That would give a good leg up in terms of starting to look at the CIP.
All right. We've got another question that has come in. This one reads, as a night supervisor at a youth program, I don't interact that much with the teens that live here. I would like to move to a day shift. Would your training help me move up in the company?
I don't know. I think it would depend on what kind of value your company puts on being a skilled person who can handle challenging, difficult clients. We do a feature on kind of like an AMA block. And so that would be, if someone was, threatening to leave or said, I don't want to be here anymore. It can take a very skilled person to work with that. I know one treatment center that has one guy who is just dedicated to that. He's been to several of our intervention trainings. So as far as making you marketable, absolutely. But it would depend on kind of what the role is that the treatment center or your work environment would be looking for you to have. I think that the intervention skills are definitely something that they don't always seem natural. So I think that for some people, kind of unlocking that kind of access to that piece of their ability can be very valuable in a work environment. I think that anyone would be a stronger worker, certainly having had this training. I think that there's a lot that we do that would make them a more desirable worker.
I think that's a great point. And as a as an employer myself, I would tell this person, the sheer fact that you are showing the desire to educate yourself and to have more knowledge to make you better at working with these young people would certainly be looked at favorably, you know, in moving up within a business or even getting hired by another business. So I agree completely that, you know, it's certainly something that is going to, you know, make you a better person, better at your job, and what employer doesn't want to see that in their employees?
Absolutely. So, I completely agree.
Now, one of the things that, that I love to do on this show is to go into success stories. Now, we've got about 8 minutes or so, but if you gentlemen could each maybe share one of your favorite success stories, I think for many of the parents that listen, and we do have quite a few, you know, they, I get the most comments back after a show when they talk about some of the success stories and how it made them feel. It gives them hope in the situation that they're in. So if you could share a couple of your personal success stories, I would appreciate it.
Sure, we'd be happy to do that. You know, I mean, I think, excuse me, for me, you know, I remember one family. It was actually a group of the children of their dad, they were concerned about their dad, and you know, their dad, you know, not the typical type of destroy everything kind of alcoholic that we hear a lot about, managed to be a great dad to them growing up. They had a lot of love and respect for him, but as they had all kind of gotten older, you know, his drinking had increased, and they were concerned more so, I guess, about the quality of his life and, you know, what the drinking was representative of, that maybe he was unhappy with where things were, and they weren't really sure how to help him. You know, they were very kind of one of those very cautious, thorough families. We spent a lot of time together talking about what the process entailed, and there was a lot of fear around, you know, gosh, you know, here's the guy who's provided for me my whole life and who really, I mean, yeah, it's difficult to be around him when he's drinking, but for the most part, he's still a great dad. And, you know, we talked through that. We talked about what the intervention would look like, what were some of the possible, what we would call motivators, and then, you know, what they came to as part of that process was the decision that, you know, we love our dad, and we're concerned enough about what's going on with his drinking that we want to help him. And that was like, even just getting to that point was really, for me, really special, because there was so much hesitancy about, are we doing the right thing? Are we doing the wrong thing? And through talking with them and kind of explaining the process and making them feel comfortable with it, you know, they decided on their own that, you know, yes, this is something we want to do. We love him enough to do this. And that's really what an intervention is. It's like the ultimate act of love for someone when they can't stop themselves to step in and say, we're willing to do whatever it takes to help you do this until you can do it for yourself. And so even without, I mean, I spoke to them for probably about a month, and I didn't know if it was going to turn into an intervention with us or if they were going to, you know, what they were going to do. We had built enough trust and rapport that they asked me to come out and do the intervention, and I was honored to be able to do that. And it was wonderful. They had, you know, like 15, I think, people, friends and family. Some participated via a laptop. Some people participated via a phone. You know, it was kind of a little different because there was a lot of discussion back and forth about, you know, some people didn't think it was bad as other people. Some people thought it was worse than other people. So kind of like bridging that gap and kind of getting everyone on the same page was really a really good process for me to go through as an interventionist. I feel I learned a lot on that intervention about how to kind of bring people in from who have a different perspective about what's going on. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you imagine we get this whole kind of team moving in the same direction, and like, you know, if you're a fan of any team sport, when everyone plays their role and does their thing, even though every play may not have a positive outcome, you know, you're going to win the game. If you're practiced, if you get together, if you all move together in the same way, you know, you have a good chance of winning. And that's what happened. And the intervention was extremely difficult. He was extremely stubborn. It was on the 15th letter where he finally said yes. I mean, we were at it for about 3.5 hours, and after every letter, he said, "Thank you for your concern, but I'm not going to go to treatment. Thank you for your concern. I love you, but I'm not going to go to treatment." And it made it really challenging, because when they're so kind of cognizant and there and they appear to be doing well, you know, that kind of making that decision, you know, kind of the you worry that the families are going to kind of, he's better than we think. He can do this on his own. You know, he is very strong-willed and strong-minded. Maybe he could do it on his own. And we just stuck to our guns. And on the 15th letter, he said yes. And we got on the plane. And, you know, he didn't have the best experience in treatment, but he's still sober, you know, and he's doing it. And he has a great relationship with his children now. And I think that's, you know, that was really, it was kind of a unique and different intervention experience, because the interventions where, you know, where it's the 22-year-old who can't get off the bed, doesn't have a job, stealing from mom and dad, like, that's an easier intervention for us. Those are generally the ones where they go right away. Those are
right.
The ones where we walk in the room and they pop out of bed and said, "Oh no, the gig's up. I'll go to treatment." You know, and we have a lot of success with that young age group. But this was a little bit different. This was a little unique. It was a really great learning experience for me. And I really think overall that the family would say that they had a really positive outcome. And even though, and what was great about it was, even though it didn't all go exactly to plan after, you know, he did go to treatment, you know, he did agree to, you know, kind of remain sober. He's still sober to this day. Even though it didn't all happen the way that we kind of envisioned it, it still had a great positive outcome. So for me, that was one of my favorite stories.
That's beautiful. And Ken?
Yep.
Yeah. Can you share one as well?
Oh, man. I mean, there's so many of them. I think one of the hardest ones that I had was chasing this guy, and it was one of the ones for the episode. His name was Brent, and chasing him for hours in the streets of the humidity in Tampa, would not go to treatment, just would not go. And back and forth, and the part that, you know, the watching the kids, you know, heartbroken, dad wouldn't go to treatment, and then he finally, you know, surrenders, because we're in Florida and they have the Marchman at the Baker Act there. And so he said, "Well, I guess we'll just have to do it that way if you're choosing not to go on your own." And his college buddy said, "Oh, you know, they're right, you know, you will have to go. And it'll be a court-appointed facility, not a nice one like that is lined up for you to go to." So he finally surrendered after hours and hours. And in treatment, did extremely well. Like, you know, all excited about, you know, being in recovery and calling me and saying, "I don't think I'm ready to go home for sober living. I think I don't, after treatment, I think I need to be in sober living. And, you know, I really want to look at my options in California and possibly Florida. Can you help me out?" And really engaged in the process and really starting to learn to love his life. And a week later, ended up finding out he had cancer and ended up going home for treatment and ended up passing away within 30 days. So, you know, it always reminds me that, you know, when you have somebody, life is so precious, you know, and to really fight for them. And, you know, it was hard. If you would have seen that episode, I mean, it was hard. He was fighting hard, and the family had to put their foot down and, you know, pretty much force him. You know, like they always say, you know, "Oh, right. You can't force somebody." Their family forced him into treatment, but he got the miracle. And the best part was his son saying, you know, "Thank God I had my dad, you know, at my baseball game, and he was clean and sober before he died."
Oh, that's beautiful. And I think one of the components in there that I'm not sure everybody caught was the fact that through the intervention, this person began to become part of the process in regards to making decisions, talking about going to California, talking about, you know, so, you know, that's kind of a nuance that people may have missed, but part of the art of this was the fact that you got him to become part of the process. And once he became part of the process, he probably didn't feel that he was being so forced, you know, that he was actually having some input and starting to recognize the value of it. So I think that's beautiful. So
yeah, I think that being part of the process is good, but also they're not going to be engaged in that unless if there's a consequence.
Exactly.
You know, like I keep saying, that, you know, if we don't have a consequence, and the consequence was you're going to do it in a government-funded facility, mm-hmm. and that's when he finally surrendered. It's all about surrendering, and that's when he surrendered and said, okay, you know, I'll do it your way, and, you know, let's go to California. But it's really important for the listeners, and when we do our trainings, is, you know, addicts, he was a pure alcoholic, so he's been drinking for years. You know, they don't make good decisions. Their decision is, let me drink myself to death, you know. So they're not making good decisions. So all of a sudden you expect them to wake up and say, oh, this is a great decision. You know, they haven't made good decisions in years. So to think that they're going to make a good decision, they have to be guided. It's kind of like, I love the way I kind of explain it to my families. It's like, you've been chasing the wild horse, you know, the disease, the wild, you've been chasing it, and you've been right behind it forever, chasing it, and chasing you through misery, bringing you and the addict through misery for years. And now it's time to get in front of the horse and guide the wild horse. So take the reins and guide them into the right decision making. And then when you guide them, then it's a process. Recovery is a process. There's no destination in recovery. It's a process. And in that process, they will learn how to choose to make good decisions. But that takes 6 months to a year. They don't make good decisions in the first 6 months. You know, they have to be guided. So you guide them gently and lovingly and point out, you know, okay, if we make this right-hand turn, this is going to be the consequences. Uh-huh. If we make this left-hand turn, look how much clearer that path looks. You know, so guiding them and working with them, you know, so they don't jump off the cliff again, because that's where these kids are dying. They're making their own decisions. They're jumping off the cliff, and they're dying. So we need to help guide them to make those healthy decisions.
All right. And for everybody out there, you know, you just heard why, you know, why we refer families to these gentlemen is because they are out there. They are saving lives. They are guiding people. You know, we focus on the transportation part, but these are the people that are out there doing the intervention and getting them to that point. So again, thank you guys so much. Again, for everybody out there, if you want more information, go to i911events.com. Ken, Eric, again, thank you so much. And please, I look forward to you coming back and sharing some more of the great stories and the good works that you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Really appreciate your time.
All right. And for everybody out there, please tune in next week when our guest Lisa Smith from Save My Family Today will discuss why feelings of isolation are attributed to an increase in depression and anxiety in young people. And if you missed any show or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or check us out on iTunes. And the next time that you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and like us. Thank you for listening. Be good humans and be with us again next week. Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.